I'm Stephanie Singer, Director of Arts and Ideas at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is Marcia Chatelain, Professor of History and African American Studies at Georgetown University. She's joined in conversation by Brandy Thompson Summers, Assistant Professor of Geography and Global Metropolitan Studies at UC Berkeley. And now, join me on stage at the JCCSF as I introduce Marcia Chatelain and Brandy Thompson Summers. Black History Month is a time each year to celebrate African American achievements, and we are so fortunate to have two of our nation's leading scholars here with us this evening to share a fascinating and important story of how black wealth was achieved in this country following the assassination of MLK. Dr. Marcia Chatelain is a Provost Distinguished Associate Professor of History and African American Studies at Georgetown University. She is a leading public voice on the history of race, education, and food culture, and makes frequent media appearances on MSNBC, CNN, PBS, and BBC America. And Professor Chatelain also currently co-hosts the Slate podcast, The Waves, a biweekly show that covers feminism, gender, and popular culture. Her books include Southside Girls, Growing Up in the Great Migration, and her just-published franchise, The Golden Arches in Black America, which explores the complicated relationship, for better or worse, between McDonald's and black communities, and we'll be hearing a lot more from Marcia about that very shortly. Appearing in conversation this evening with Dr. Chatelain is Dr. Brandy Thompson Summers, Assistant Professor of Geography and Global Metropolitan Studies at the University of California, Berkeley. Her book, Black in Place, The Spatial Aesthetics of Race in a Post-Chocolate City, explores how aesthetics and race converge to locate or map blackness in Washington, D.C. Let's give them both a very warm welcome.
I'm letting everyone in on a secret. We are really friends.
Yes.
Like real friends. Like we go over each other's houses,
yes,
kind of friend.
There's a lot of texting.
Like I leave my child with her kind of friend. Like that's the kind of friends we are. And so it's really wonderful to sit up here with my friend and to celebrate her amazing book. I was going to read it anyway, but this gave me a wonderful reason to read it early. So I want to thank everyone for being here. And also for inviting me to be here. It's just, again, wonderful to be in this incredible conversation to talk about this incredible book. So for us, it's easier to have a conversation than me to feel like I'm interviewing you. So, of course, I have those questions about the book. Like, it's impeccably researched. I'm not quite clear how you were able to research in such detail, but then also to write the book in a way where I felt like you interviewed every single person who was in the book. And so I'm going to start with that. Tell us about the research process and then also these archives that you definitely delved into.
Yeah. So when people find out that you write a book about a corporation, they'll say, oh, did they invite you to their headquarters to go through their stuff? Absolutely not. 9 out of 10 times when people are doing corporate histories that aren't commissioned, you do not have access to the papers. And so when I first started this project, it was supposed to be a book about the relationship between food and the civil rights movement. And there were chapters about all sorts of topics, and I would sit in meetings with editors, and they'd say, wow, the first 5 chapters are incredibly boring, but this one chapter, this idea about thinking about the relationship between McDonald's and African Americans, that could be the entire story. Mm. And what that pushed me to do is to say, well, how do I research this without McDonald's participation? Mm. But the reason I wrote this book is that in many ways, we know a story of McDonald's that are about the founders in San Bernardino, about Ray Kroc's obsessive dedication to expanding the brand. We know about its global context, but in many renderings of the McDonald's stories, African Americans are not present. Mm-hmm. And so when I centered the black experience of McDonald's and visited the archives of Black mayors, of Black civil rights organizations, Black community groups, McDonald's is everywhere in the archives. I don't know if they are aware of how much of their stuff is really out there, because they probably are looking for it in the business history libraries, and they're not looking at the papers of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference or the NAACP or the Urban League. But when I understood just how much fast food franchising was dependent on Black politics, on Black civil rights organizations, on Black notables, the archive just kind of, there was so much. I could have written a 10-volume set on African Americans and fast food, but no one's going to publish that. So we have franchise.
It worked. So I think one of the things that stood out also about the book is not only understanding the origins of McDonald's, but recognizing this relationship with the Black community, but Black communities. So on the one hand, we're talking about the civil rights movement, this wide scale, like national movement that's happening at this time. But then we're also seeing a glimpse in Cleveland. We're looking in LA. We're looking in these different locations. And so being a geographer now, I'm interested in how McDonald's maps a particular Black experience in America.
Absolutely. So what I wanted to capture was the way that, Naomi Klein, when she published Disaster Capitalism, she did such a good job of laying out the ways that capital comes in after chaos. Mm-hmm. And so she talks about Hurricane Katrina. She talks about the revolutions in Chile in the 1970s. She talks about austerity in the UK. And she talks about post-apartheid South Africa as these spaces in which anything can happen. And because people are so vulnerable, this is when the marketplace is flooded, mm-hmm. right, with capital. And I think for African Americans in struggle, this is the same process. Mm-hmm. The assassination of King, the uprisings in Los Angeles in 1992, Ferguson in 2014. When the dust settles, the environment becomes ripe for all of this economic development that is supposed to guarantee that there will not be uprisings again, but never gets into the real reasons why people are so frustrated, they're so angry, and they're so alienated, right? So people get businesses and they don't get a response to police brutality. People get a new investment opportunity. They don't get better schools or better housing for themselves and their children. And so all of this is to say that when we think about spaces in which McDonald's is appearing after King's assassination, I wanted to capture the fact that in many Black communities, people didn't know what to make of McDonald's. For many of us, it's hard to imagine a world without McDonald's, or to imagine a world in which we meet people who've never been to a McDonald's or don't understand it. And in each of these places where McDonald's is trying to capitalize in this moment of chaos in order to expand their business, the communities are making demands on McDonald's and asking them really probing questions about what kind of presence are you going to be here. And so in Chicago, they're embraced as this great economic opportunity. But in Portland, the Black Panther Party is saying, not quite. And in Philadelphia, in some neighborhoods, people are saying absolutely not to McDonald's. And I wanted to remind people that there is actually a history of resistance to these brands and to these industries that we think have to be inevitable parts of our lives.
Mm-hmm. And so, and you actually, I think more towards the end of the book, you really tackle representation or ways that, and you know, I remember the 80s, like you saw McDonald's. I mean, Calvin, when was Calvin? Was he the 80s?
Calvin was like 90.
Okay. So I'm remembering seeing Calvin working at his job at McDonald's. Black History Month, you'd see like music, or you'd have all of these activities, the McDonald's All-American with basketball and all the different figures that would come around and really tout McDonald's, and they'd have like their jerseys and have the McDonald's emblem on them. And so I think in particular, you're thinking about and you're tackling and really wrestling with how much representation means to the Black community.
Absolutely. I mean, representation is so, it's so complicated because there's a part of me that says representation is not enough. Mm-hmm. There's a great new book by Kianga Yamada Taylor called Race for Profit, and she talks about predatory inclusion. Like, what does it mean when we open up opportunities for people to have a closer relationship to capitalism that will ultimately sink them? Right. You know, it's home buying program for people living in poverty. Right. It's bringing in a fast food franchise in a community that desperately needs a public library and a mental health service, mm-hmm. and saying, but we're bringing in jobs, so you're going to like it, right? So all of these issues point to the fact that representation is so complicated under capitalism and under racism because you're not quite sure you can say no. Because if you say no, are you then depriving your community of a little bit of something? Sure. And these are the dilemmas that, you know, this part of the country is grappling with constantly, right? The influence of tech, the influence of these industries that provide something, mm-hmm. but can never really mediate the problems of homelessness and of inequality. And I used to live in Oklahoma City. When I taught at the University of Oklahoma, you know, these employers would come in with these jobs that paid really low, and people would say, but it's Oklahoma. You can afford to live on that. Mm-hmm. You can't, right? And so all of this is to say that the representation part is particularly poignant in this period when people say, well, I want to support a black-owned business, and it may not be really black-owned. It's a fast food franchise, but this is the closest we will have to this experience. So yes, you know, so there's a great enthusiasm even when there is a discomfort.
So you've brought up capital and capitalism. And
my favorite topic.
I know it is. So I was going to try to wait, but let's talk a little bit about that. More so, I mean, the capaciousness of capitalism. Like, capitalism is really generative, very productive, and so damning, especially to communities of color. And so I want you to kind of talk through really how you use the franchising model to critique capitalism.
So franchising is bananas to me because it's an invitation to assume liability that a stronger party should be assuming, in my perspective. So the National Labor Relations Board just issued a statement that reversed a previous statement under the last administration or the past administration that said, yeah, like wage issues and healthcare, that's the franchisee's problem. Mm-hmm. You know, the corporate parent, it's not their problem. What? Right? What are we talking about? It's like if I say, hey, Brandy, you are invited to pay my mortgage and you have to deal with the repairs on my house, but you can sleep in my guest room whenever you want. And you're like, I don't know why I would do that. In the same ways that the franchise industry presents the possibility of financial success. Right. But to clear that hurdle is so hard. And what's so amazing about these black franchise owners, they're able to do it. Mm-hmm. They are able to find a way to generate a lot of profits, to do the community goodwill and the outreach, to give the jobs, but they will ultimately always feel the weight of the role that they have to play. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I try to be very clear that we are all susceptible to capitalism's, like, you know, many seductive qualities. I don't try to think that I'm smarter than any advertising campaign because they will get me in the end, right? I'll say, oh, the advertisers are trying to sell this to me. And then I'm like, huh, maybe I should get this face cream. Huh, maybe I would look more refreshed. You know, I mean, I struggled with this. Here I'm in San Francisco, such a fabulous city. And I was like, should I make time to go shopping or should I spend time with my friends? Wait, what? I just wrote a whole book on why you're not supposed to do that. So I try to concede the point that in 1968, when your community feels eviscerated, the opening of a McDonald's feels hopeful. Mm. And that's real. That when you don't see yourself on television watching a commercial that may feel a little racist, right, but has African Americans in it, can feel good. Sure. Because I think that if we deny the pleasure that capitalism does provide, then we will always lose sight of its power. Mm-hmm. And we will never feel that we can actually confront it in the honest ways that it does shape our lives and it does do something to us.
Well, that still complicates the notion of black wealth in ways mm-hmm. that these franchisees are becoming rich, essentially. And also, you know, the conversations that we have now about representation, because that still relates, where if we just had more Black people behind the scenes, then they'd make different decisions. And so we're seeing they're hiring Borrell Communications, they're hiring these, you know, and a lot white collar Black entrepreneurs and business people to really work with McDonald's to try to cater to this community of folks who's consuming the heck out of some burgers, right? So how does that, how does that kind of play into this idea?
So this one's really difficult because representation is just that, right? It's a projection of an image and it's never structural change. And it's, we go through these moments of it. You know, we're both in academia, and the past 12 months, there have been so many announcements of Black presidents of colleges and universities, and it's a big deal. I went to Brown for graduate school when Ruth Simmons was the first Black woman to lead an Ivy League school, first Black person to do it. This is not a small thing, because when she was president of Brown, I feel like people saw me differently, right? They saw things in me that were always there, but now Ruth Simmons was a prism in which to see me as someone who's talented or capable. Sure. But her capacity to fundamentally upend an Ivy League school, that's not part of the deal, right? And so we are constantly seeing these people who are really believing that if they just work really hard, that they can turn the tide. And then they start to engage in behavior where they are not bringing in a tide of union organizing at McDonald's. They're not leading the tide of raising wages, right? They see themselves as also in a precarious position. You know, I really struggled writing this book because I thought, I'm really highlighting the pain of aggrieved millionaires. And I'm like, I don't know how I feel about that. But the grievance comes in recognizing the limits of capitalism and racism. When they come together, you will be a millionaire, but you will not be a multimillionaire like your white colleague. And you will be a millionaire one day, but you might lose your restaurant, and a lot of Black people may lose their jobs. And so I think that when we think about what inclusion is, the purpose of inclusion, I think we have to really think very carefully about what does it mean when we change the complexion of the room, but we still give power to the room.
Right. And so Marsha came to campus yesterday and spoke to law students, which was interesting because I'm always curious. I'm always assuming that they want to be corporate attorneys and make a lot of money and really kind of change the world that way. But it was interesting because you talked about McDonald's as essentially like a real estate company.
100%.
And I want you to talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I think that what people in the business world, when they write about McDonald's in case studies, they say McDonald's is a real estate company that offers you a hamburger if you feel like it, right? They own the property underneath which their stores are built. And this creates an incredible wealth portfolio. And what I discovered in writing this book is that after 68, when McDonald's is going into some of these communities that have been blighted from uprisings, they're getting land for cheaper. And so at the moment where white-owned small businesses are doing this great economic white flight and exodus out of these communities. And we all know in places like the Bronx, places like Detroit, people are, you know, arson becomes a very lucrative field because people are just collecting insurance. McDonald's is able to buy that property for cheaper. And so you start to see the way that disaster capitalism is working for the franchise industry and other brands. They're not surviving the 70s as well as McDonald's is because they're getting into the real estate game. And even now, when people say, is McDonald's still a strong brand? They're in neighborhoods that are gentrifying. The land values are now going up, and they still own that land. And the franchise owner who's toiling on that land has to contend now with higher taxes. One of the things that is very clear very early on when African Americans get into franchising is they're paying higher security and insurance costs to do businesses in the communities that many argue that those are the only places where they have their opportunities. So you start to see this way that property and even the language of discrimination is used in franchising. So I talk about someone who argues that he is being redlined out of getting a McDonald's in the suburbs. There are people who say that they want to go into small business, but they can't get bank loans unless they do franchising. People talk about networks of white franchise owners who want to keep Black people from coming into their neighborhoods. And so, you know, where capitalism is, real estate isn't far along, and then patriarchy is like coming right down the road to add to this.
You're listening to Professor of History and African American Studies at Georgetown University, Marcia Chatelain, whose new book is Franchise, The Golden Arches in Black America. She's joined in conversation by Brandi Thompson Summers on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
So still staying along those lines and thinking about wealth, but particularly black capitalism.
That's right. You said black wealth.
So thinking, you talk about this shift essentially from black capitalism to black empowerment. And I'd say we're going back to black capitalism.
Well,
now,
look who's in the White House. I mean, this is... now you put four quarters in me.
I know.
This is where I get really grumpy. There's an idea that emerges after King's assassination. And it's this idea that in order for black people to grow up, they have to embrace black capitalism. Mm-hmm. And the two people who are so important to this story that if every day I think about how I would rewrite this book, I'm not going to, but if I rewrote this book, I would emphasize the ways that Jesse Jackson and Jim Brown, the athlete who was on the Cleveland Browns, and he played lacrosse also, and he's everywhere. Mm-hmm. These two guys survive all of the different twists and turns of movement. But what Jesse Jackson is saying very early on after King's assassination is that we have to move from civil rights to silver rights. Mm-hmm. That our growing up as a people is to abandon this notion essentially of beloved community, and community investment is where we're going to go. And he is at the forefront of these boycotts and these selective buying campaigns to pressure the fast food industry to create more franchise opportunities and to deposit more money in black banks, hire black accountants and lawyers. And so you see the white collar class is really enriched by this. I know a lot of people who had opportunities because of McDonald's corporate diversity plan, but workers are completely left behind in this situation. So back to this question of black wealth, I've been in all of these conversations about black wealth, and increasingly I have to say, most of us will not be millionaires, right? Most of us won't pay our student loans. Oh, sorry, students in the room. Real talk. It's like being in my office at Georgetown, pay your student loans. But, you know, and so this idea of black generational wealth was just also a conversation a lot of people want to have. We have to redefine what we can pass on.
Absolutely.
Because if we are so fixated on wealth, then we start to see the extremes that people will go to have that wealth and consolidate that power along their family lines, instead of saying your family stories are wealth. Your ability to strategize how to stay in your home in Oakland is wealth, right? Like, these are part of it. And so black wealth becomes this way of softening capitalism and believing that wealth accumulation is civil rights.
Sure.
It's not. Thank you. Thank you.
So I'm going to make you mad again.
Oh, are you going to make me mad?
Because
are you going to talk about Mike Bloomberg?
I am.
Yes. I saw some friends beforehand and I was like, oh, someone's just going to bring him up.
Well, it's important. I don't watch television. However,
you're so much better for it. That's why you're so lovely. This is Brandy's secret.
So my grandmother was at my place. She's watching my daughter, and she had the television on. So I heard a commercial, and it was McKissick.
Yeah, McKissick commercial.
Yes.
I saw it in Cleveland, and it's been following me on this book tour, you guys.
Yes. And so there have been a number of wealthy black people who are supporting and stumping for Mike Bloomberg. And so this helps us think about this history. It's a long history. Mm-hmm. This is not new. All these mayors, like London Breed is supported, like in D.C. There are a number of black mayors, and again, black wealthy folks who are supporting Bloomberg. And I don't want to have a political conversation necessarily, but I want to have you think through the lens of the book to talk about how black capitalism is reemerging in this important way.
You have to give me instructions or it goes off the rails. So I want to go back to Jim Brown and Jesse Jackson, because they remain in terms of the shifts from black capitalism civil rights to civil rights, black opportunity, black empowerment, and because of who's in the White House, black capitalism is back. It is not a coincidence that one of the first meetings at Trump Tower, Jim Brown is there.
Yes, he was.
Right?
Yes, he was.
Jim Brown's at the end of this book, you guys. He comes, he is able to stay through. And if this president weren't so noxious, those same people would be endorsing him. Mm-hmm. Because it's the idea that if you cannot realize the full dignity of civil rights in its kind of most idealistic and ideologically pure ways, mm-hmm. then at least you should be able to stay well fed. Mm-hmm. And this idea, it's funny because I think African Americans are big believers in trickle-down economics. They don't like the way Reagan did it, right. But it's the same idea of wealth and proximity that has fueled the black business elite. You know, the franchise owner of the 20th and 21st century is the person in the 19th century who had the funeral home and who had the one general store that's black owned. This is a person who becomes an unelected official in black America because they are able to extend credit because the bank won't, mm-hmm. or you are the bank that extends credit to black people. But you're the one who's also negotiating something when the sheriff comes to your section of town and is trying to round people up. You're the person who brokers the deal where you say, we won't push for integration, but can you add another story to our, you know, black high school? You're the person constantly negotiating. And so in many ways, to see black politicians and to see, you know, iconic businesses like McKissick and McKissick line up behind Bloomberg, these were people who were also, if they were alive, or their families were lining up behind Nixon, knowing full well that Nixon wasn't a friend of civil rights, but silver rights, Nixon could do that. Because what black empowerment and black capitalism doesn't do, it doesn't question racial apartheid at all. Right. It says we make the most out of racial apartheid. And this is where I get grumpy. So grumpy.
It's still important to think about the ways that this is a never-ending cycle, right?
I mean, it can end. We just have to be so – we have to scream so loud. But it is a never-ending cycle because the alternative is so bleak because the starvation is so deep. Mm. So what? You don't want jobs in your community?
Right.
I don't know if I have – I don't have that type of integrity to say no to jobs right. when people are saying we need jobs. Sure. I mean, this is the whole thing with Amazon in the Bronx. You know, one of my talks earlier this month was in Cleveland in a predominantly black suburb. And this incredible library system and 70 people come out. And as I'm driving back to the hotel, a giant Amazon fulfillment center across the street from a dog track.
Really?
Like a casino,
yeah.
Right? These were the two economic development programs in that city.
So you also, I know yesterday we were thinking a lot about power and mm-hmm. ways that McDonald's can create this system without giving up any power mm-hmm. and having franchisees fight over these small crumbs, but also these communities also fight over the crumbs. So they're not able to politically make any headway with these changes. So talk a little bit about power and how really has McDonald's relinquished any over this time?
You know, I will say this is what I'll say about the power question. It's so excellent because there are these little snapshots between like 69 and 74 where people are pushing back. Mm-hmm. The Black Panther Party for Self-Defense in Portland is saying you have to give to the breakfast program. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in Philadelphia and Ogons, people are like, we don't want this in our neighborhood. And in Cleveland, people are saying we need to own the means of production. Right. We need to be the franchise owners. So there's all of these different things. And what McDonald's understands, which is brilliant, they understand that they can graft themselves onto a civil rights narrative super easily. And this is the part that I thought was really fascinating. When we think of the sit-in movement of the 1960s, and when we think of the student sit-in at Woolworth in Greensboro on February 1st, 1960, we often associate it with brands that are no longer with us. So Katz's Drugs, Woolworth's, Rexall, which is not as big as it used to be. Yeah. McDonald's was also a target of the sit-in movement. Mm-hmm. But they have been completely erased from that narrative so brilliantly that the number of people who said, I don't think I realized the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee was attacking McDonald's corporate in Chicago to desegregate in the South. Or I didn't realize that after victories in Greensboro, people were going to Durham and going to High Point, North Carolina to desegregate McDonald's. Mm. And I was like, huh, how did they escape that one? Mm. Well, after 1968, their gestures towards Black America was considered socially progressive. Mm-hmm. And the idea that you would replace a white franchise owner who no longer wants to do business in Black communities with a Black person and celebrate that as progress, yes, is where people were in 1968. Mm-hmm. And so I bring this up because McDonald's history, if you saw the movie The Founder with Michael Keaton, it was all about his rigidity and his desire to consolidate power with distributors, with the McDonald's brothers to build this empire. But Ray Kroc was a genius because he understood flexibility when it would help at the bottom line. Mm. So he didn't love that the Black franchise owners wanted to create their own organization, but he understood that allowing it created this opportunity for them to be a buffer when their community demands happen. Mm. And he didn't particularly believe in some of the politics of Black franchise owners, mm, but he understood that by allowing them to use their money to fund the United Negro College Fund, that that would be returned to McDonald's a millionfold. Absolutely. So, you know, everyone is rigid and everyone is racist until a bunch of money comes in front of you, and then everyone's flexibly tolerant.
Right. Right.
God, that's so depressing. Oh, so, whew, that was a downer.
But then you do have these McDonald's operators who are preaching this gospel. Like, and so tell us about the experience of going to the convention.
Oh my gosh, McDonald's franchise owners, bless all of their hearts, are so sweet. They were so excited for me to come because they felt like this was the first time someone's going to really, you know, be honest about how great they are. And people would say things to me, and they meant it. They would say, you know, my McDonald's is my ministry. I'm like, whoa, like, what do you mean by that? Right? And they say, if it wasn't for me, the kids wouldn't have Pop Warner football. And if it wasn't for me, there wouldn't be Little League here. And when a person is a returning, you know, citizen, they can get a job with me. I don't care if you have a felony conviction record. You can get a job here, right? Or, you know, look at the historically Black colleges. I'm allowing these scholarships to have, you know, to happen. I met a gentleman. He's the largest donor in the history of Fisk University. He endowed the business library at Purdue University. As someone in higher education, these are not small things, right? And so I understand how in the United States, especially for many of these people who didn't come for wealth, the idea that you can be a multimillionaire and own all of these businesses, that is incredible. But what I would like them to do now, because they have the opportunity to consolidate their power, is to start asking different questions of what would it mean for their ministry to be animated in the lives of working people in a different way, not just the job. Mm. You know, there are a lot of people who also supply the fast food industry. And what's interesting is when you talk to franchise owners, they'll say, you think I do well? That guy over there, he's really rich. And I'm like, I have no money, so everyone's rich to me. And they'd say that guy is a supplier.
Right.
And suppliers are really the smart ones, right, because they don't assume the liability of a franchise and they're supplying McFlurry spoons. Right. I mean, it's also such a distinct thing. Or, right, you know, paper products in the southwest of the country. They really have hacked the system. So in some fast food restaurants, instead of issuing checks or direct deposit to employees, they give them these check cards and they have fees. And if you don't withdraw the money, right? And someone said to me, you know, people say thank you all the time for doing that. I was like, really, do they? And he says, because, you know, they don't have banks. So they wouldn't be able to have a card to go to Redbox and take out a DVD, and now they have this card. And I'm like, bro, yeah, maybe we should work on getting posted, you know, the like post office to become a community bank. Maybe we could work on that. And then that's not going to happen, but that's where I wanted to say, you know, in my heart, I was like, you feel like you're solving a problem, but here's a way that we can just eliminate this problem,
sure,
right?
This desire for inclusion, though, at every level. And that's what it seems to be throughout the book. It's you want them to win, but then you don't because you see what perpetuates if they do.
And also, I think, you know, it's difficult to reckon with our relationship, right, to any kind of inequality. We all struggle with this. But also, I think it's important to note that there's this weird tension that the other through line, other than Jesse Jackson and Jim Brown, is the fact that everyone is trying to struggle with this idea of what does it mean to buy Black and yes. why is it important?
Yes.
Why is it important to support a Black business? Mm-hmm. Is it for the sake that you want to enrich the wealth of Black people? Mm-hmm. Do you want to know that the businesses in your community are viable? Do you stand in solidarity with them? Like, what are our motivations? And when we're unable to do that, it creates this kind of big place where people are made vulnerable mm-hmm. to say, well, you can buy kind of Black or you're buying close to Black. Mm-hmm. And it creates a lot of dis-ease in communities because people aren't quite sure what they're striving for.
So dis-ease, I want to move to disease and think about food. Mm-hmm. So this is a fast food company, right?
Yes, it is.
And again, we see that Black people are consuming at the, not, I won't say alarming rates, but alarming rates in terms of fries and burgers and the apple pies. And, you know, I remember getting the, actually, my mom didn't let me eat a lot of McDonald's. But anyway, just what, or have you gotten feedback from those who are interested in thinking about health disparities?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. People see your book and they're like, oh, this is great. It's going to be about food deserts. I'm like, right. Okay, it's about capitalism, but it's kind of about food deserts. Buy the book first. When people think of a book about African Americans and fast food, they think that it's going to lead with all the nutrition yes. stuff. And I don't really talk about the food that much for a reason. It's not about the food. It's about the affective bonds that are made under racial capitalism. It's the fact that the second you see that commercial, you melt into nostalgia. Mm-hmm. It's the fact that for me, Black franchise owners helped introduce me to the richness of Black history, mm-hmm. Including some of my favorite Martin Luther King, short documentaries when I was a kid. It's about the fact that if we are serious about a nutritional and health revolution in the United States, we have to understand the history of how we got here, and we have to understand that people are exercising consumer choices for a lot of reasons yeah. other than French fries are fantastic. I wrote this book because I was so uncomfortable with the tone that was taken in how people assessed why people were eating fast food and why they let their children have it, instead of saying, if we could imagine that fast food is the most practical and viable option under certain conditions, what are we going to do about those conditions to change it? Mm-hmm. A lot of people say, you know, I'm trying to teach kids about nutrition, and I'm like, that's great. But do you know if everyone's home, like if they're able to pay their electric bill? You know, like if you have running electricity, you can fill it with fruits and vegetables. But if people can't pay their utilities, then it's not helpful. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm from the Midwest and it gets so cold in the wintertime and you can't legally cut off someone's heat. But the second the temperature gets to a certain degree, the utility companies are like, too bad, no heat for you. Right. And so where is all this food going to be prepared? And so I want us to really, really use history as a tool mm-hmm. for thinking about food justice. Mm-hmm. But I also want, you know, folks in the food justice movement to understand that sometimes consuming McDonald's is about supporting an idea of Black progress, of Black wealth, of Black solidarity, that once we kind of attack that, we give people more headspace to imagine different ways of consuming.
I've made you mad today. So I want you to tell us your favorite part of writing this book.
Oh my gosh. I love fast food ephemera. Here's the thing about fast food. We think of it as, you know, the food isn't the best and the aesthetics aren't awesome, but the creativity that fuels this industry is something I came to a deep appreciation for. There's a guy named Bernie Wood, and his papers are at the National Museum of American History. And in his archive are all of his prototypes of the things that he had to create for the fast food industry. You know, a garbage can that like looks like Grimace, or, you know, McDonald's had a lot of bad ideas. Ray Kroc was really bad at ideas for food. He was great at capitalism, bad at food. And so he would come up with these desserts that never got off the ground. And looking at the 3D model of how you would create a shortcake carrier so you could order six at a time and carry them to your car. And it's so much cardboard and there's so much styrofoam. Young people, ask your parents about styrofoam. But, you know, there's so much creative energy that goes into it that I started to really develop an appreciation for the built environment of fast food and all of the things that it indexes. And then, you know, the African-American themed ads, they do not age well. I fully understand. A lot of them are very racist. And recognizing in 1972, seeing a black family eating at a McDonald's in an ad is revolutionary. And watching all of the creative people who made the commercials, not just the celebrities that were known, like DeBarge did commercials and, you know, people like Michael Jordan who were famous, but to think about the backup singers who get a break because they're doing McDonald's commercials, all of the creatives who had to style a black aesthetic for a fast food, it made me really appreciate that. And the and just the number of Black History Month themed products that came out of it. There's like a whole MC Light rap about Harriet Tubman, like the and there's like a narration about Arturo Schomburg and the importance of the Schomburg Library. And I'm like, this is kind of cool, and this should not be coming from a corporation.
Right?
Like we have money called we put into taxes for public resources that should be underwriting this creative cultural life so that McDonald's can just provide burgers. I'm not even upset of they just provide burgers, but when they are underwriting, you know, the creative and the intellectual lives of people, this is when I start to get upset again.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's guest is Professor of History and African American Studies at Georgetown University, Marcia Chatelain, whose new book is Franchise, The Golden Arches in Black America. She's joined in conversation by Brandy Thompson Summers. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at KALW.org.
So you start the book talking about Ferguson and setting the stage, right? And you really kind of end it in that way as well, and thinking about today and thinking about rebellions in these major cities where police brutality, we're seeing uneven development, we're seeing gentrification ravage so many different places. And so you talked about the paraphernalia not aging well, but I'm wondering, aside from McDonald's being this real estate corporation, how is McDonald's aging in terms of this particular history?
I think they're struggling in a marketplace that now has diversity of food. I think I was talking about this yesterday or earlier today. I talk a lot about this. The fact that McDonald's now has competitors that have more interesting types of foods. And the fact that we are now in a landscape where fast casual for a few dollars more provides us this veneer of health. You guys, it's still not good for you. So we have better quality fast delivery of food to kind of hyper segment that market. And so I think, you know, now McDonald's is the food of people who, you know, need to eat something fast, but I think will then become the quick food of the hyper poor, and then the working poor is eating something a little different. And the fact that our supermarkets have so much readily made foods. And so as a result, McDonald's kind of takes a different kind of position for eaters. It's also been so slammed for its nutritional content, which is a good critique, but I think all of the food purveyors should be. And so it is now in a place also, there's been some really good reporting recently from Business Insider. There are fewer and fewer Black McDonald's franchise owners over the past, I think, about 15 years because they can't make the money that they used to. I think one of the reports said that an average Black franchise owner is now making $60,000 less a month. Right? And then the move towards modernization of stores falls on the franchise owners. And so now McDonald's is competing with fast casual, but they're also competing with one of the most popular fast food sources, Starbucks. Right? It's not fast food because you know, the walls are green, it is still fast food, right? And so McDonald's coffee machines, like at the last financial collapse, the paper markets were going bananas because people needed all these coffee machines and they couldn't get them. So they're now having to do coffee. They're having to provide Wi-Fi. They're having to do touch screens, right? And so I think, again, McDonald's still remains this excellent prism to understand race and capitalism and the mechanization of work and that it will... I think McDonald's always has a capacity to shapeshift.
Sure.
But it'll just be interesting in the light of gentrification, the places in which it does that hyper-concentration. I think it might start thinking about the fact that the suburbs are becoming more racially and ethnically diverse and poorer as the place where that happens, right? They're smart people. And so they will figure out a way, but I think they have been struggling to keep up with some of the changes in the market.
Do you think that everyone's preoccupation with diversity now has also shifted their dominance in that marketplace? And so the ability to kind of do the Black History Month celebration, everybody's doing that. So McDonald's isn't special anymore, right?
Yeah. You know, that was, I think, the most poignant part of writing the book was looking at how early they align themselves with the MLK holiday and the consequences of that. And so McDonald's, people say, well, you know, why did you pick McDonald's? Aren't the other franchise industry, you know, leaders doing the same in terms of recruiting franchisees of color and the marketing? But they created the form.
Right.
Everyone is trying to do a version of what McDonald's did. And the consequences are interesting. So we now have the recruitment of franchisees of color across different brands. And some of the same complaints and concerns about access happen. We also have the ethnic commercial. But what's happening is they're now being done by predominantly white advertising agencies that are able to either recruit creatives of color or just watch enough of the commercials and you know how to do it, right? I did an entire day at the Paley Center watching these commercials. I'm now an advertising genius, right? You know, you do gospel music for Sunday morning breakfast and you do hip hop for, you know, a cheeseburger and you keep it moving. And so the power that people were able to consolidate as a result of how McDonald's did, the repetition and the replication now, I think, has disempowered the class of Black people who were then empowered by it. And so now when you see, you know, franchises, the access, the amount of capital you have to get a McDonald's franchise is very high. So it's not the people that I interviewed who said, you know, I cashed out my 401k, we took all of our savings, we went into a minority franchising program, we got our first McDonald's, we were able to leverage. Now it's a person who said, you know, I made a lot of money in whatever industry, and so I bought 10. I bought 10, right? And I now that's part of a wider portfolio of wealth. And so some of those things have changed, but the narrative of diversity and inclusion still are able to be deployed in order to create market loyalties.
So I'm also wondering about McDonald's is a global brand. And so how does its relationship to the rest of the world really contribute to this story as well?
Well, it's so distinct because when they understood market segmentation among African Americans, they used some of those same logics when they went overseas. But as many of you know who've ever traveled, I'm the worst for this. I have to have a very large coffee in the morning, and this makes me an ugly American. But, you know, I'll be like some of the greatest places in Europe, but I was like, this is a thimble of coffee. I need it in a drum, right? And I'll go to, you know, what American brand has, and they'll give me a drum of coffee, and I'll feel ready for the day. But this, when you go to a fast food restaurant overseas, and you're like, why is the food so much better? It really puts into stark focus just how supply chain and tolerance for artificial flavorings and preservatives, how different they are globally, right? So the food will taste better because what's tolerated to be called food is different. So there's some of that. But also the fact that because McDonald's is probably the greatest symbol of Western imperialism, there is a class, a different class distinction of going to a McDonald's where it is often elites, you know, youth elites who go to McDonald's because it's very expensive, right? It might have tariffs and the experience is so different. And so in the same way that everyone in the U.S. eats McDonald's, but McDonald's is strangely racialized as Black.
Yes.
Everyone around the globe understands McDonald's as an American brand, but they don't experience McDonald's like most Americans do. Mm-hmm. But it still works. I mean, it's like that with... I had the greatest meal of my life at a Pizza Hut in Hong Kong. It was so elegant. I couldn't believe where I was, right? But when I think of... Pizza Hut, I think of going for my birthday as a kid and the trapezoidal windows and then the salad bar, right? Make it healthy. But we're, both of those places are Pizza Huts, but what they're signaling are, is so different.
Okay, so I'm going to ask one last question. Mm-hmm. I think for people who write books or a book, you always have those things that you couldn't include. Not the things that were mm-hmm. cut, but those things that you couldn't include because it was outside of the scope. So if you had to think about that, what would you have done? Not the cutting floor stuff, but again, what do you imagine being that thing that you would have added?
I know there's some graduate students in the audience. This is your dissertation. You should write this. It'll be great. I wish that I could have really delved into this idea of supply. Mm-hmm. And supply chain. Mm-hmm. And what does it mean when you need so many potatoes and you need so many, you know, pieces of white fish with the introduction of fish fillet? Mm-hmm. You need so much volume in order to essentially allow the industry to continue. And I wanted, I should have, it wouldn't have fit in the book, so I shouldn't do anything, but to think about supply chain and how that has a racialized dynamic in terms of labor and in terms of the environments in which all this food has to be produced. Right. Because I think that this is a story about other communities of color and their relationship to McDonald's as harvesters and as people who are supplying and who are invisible. Mm-hmm. There's no commercial. I think McDonald's tried to, when they got a lot of pushback about like pink slime and preservatives, they wanted to be like, this is the farmer who harvested your tomato. It's not the farmer, right? But but those aren't the people you see in the commercial. Right. You don't celebrate the diversity of the farm workers who are harvesting all of this, right? And so to try to think about those together would have been a different book. So someone write that book. People are writing those books.
So still would have been about capitalism. So that's
I mean, it always is. I stay on brand.
So I want to invite people to come and ask questions. So Stephanie, are you?
I thought the franchise model was more of a somebody gets a loan for $100,000, pays McDonald's, and then does that. But it seems like that's not how it works. Can you explain a little bit more?
So let's say I start a franchise business and I'm franchising hot takes on politics. And so I tell you how to do it. So there's the directions. But part of the agreement is you pay the initial fee to enter the relationship, but you owe me royalties on everything you make, but you also have to use the suppliers that I determine, right? So you can't one day say, oh, I know I have a hookup on tomatoes. I'm going to go to this guy. Mm-mm. You use my suppliers. You also are responsible for the equipment. Mm-hmm. And so you might lease the equipment. You might buy the equipment. You pay the workers. You have to source their uniforms, right? There's a catalog and you decide. You have to meet all of those demands and you have to pay into the advertising fund for national ads. You have some responsibilities for the local philanthropy. There might be I believe there's a collective responsible for local ads. And so after you pay all of that and your rent, then you have money in your pocket.
I'm not exactly sure how to ask this, but you know, Bryan Stevenson said that slavery never ended. It just evolved into the mass incarceration of men, of black men and women. But I was just wondering, when you were talking about the corporation owning the land and then the people toiling on it, it sort of sounded a little bit like sharecropper.
So the language, again, not my language, people have said this about franchising to me. Marcia Chatelain did not come up with this metaphor. People in the franchise industry have. They say, well, it's like sharecropping because it's so hard to get ahead because you are so confined not only by the physical space but all the rules and regulations of franchising. And so there is a case in the 1980s where an African-American franchise owner in Los Angeles is saying that he's being redlined. He's not allowed to go into the suburbs and enjoy profiting in a community in which the costs of doing business are lower. And McDonald's pushes back and says, well, we gave you an opportunity. Why are you so ungrateful? And he says, you don't employ 600 people. I employ 600 people. And he says, you know, he is the, he grew up in the Jim Crow South sharecropping. Mm. And he uses that language of, you know, McDonald's not respecting his authority as a man in his household and all of this kind of rhetoric. And there's some very similar ways. Now, sharecroppers don't make millions of dollars. We fully recognize it. But this idea of authority and autonomy and the limits of it, even when you are making a lot of money and contributing to the profits of a larger system, there's a real poignancy because people do make that, use that metaphor.
I was wondering, do you see, just from your research, a way out of the capitalist system being the actual creator of the imbalances and the injustices and the inequality? And second of all, do you think that at this point, the pursuit of imperialism created racism, but now racism is a strategy of imperialism?
Ooh, please come join us on this channel. I mean, yes to all of it. I think, you know, it's kind of like, what can we do? What can we do? I think at the kind of most, the basic level is be discerning when we are talking about one thing and we get a different answer. Anyone running for president, if they are asked about an anti-poverty, a reparations, or racial justice platform, starts talking about business development, tell them to stop lying to you and run out the room, because these things don't cohere. But this is what particularly Black America has been served. You know, we want the police to stop terrorizing us. We want fair and equal housing. And people hear, oh, you want a business. What? Right? And so we continue in those logics that everyone needs to just develop an app. And I know this hits close to home in this area. Everyone just needs to outsmart capitalism and then they can be part of it. This does not work. And so I think that we're at this wonderful inflection point where at least in even the most kind of like mainstream and boring conversation about politics, people are like, but what are we going to do about capitalism, you guys? Like, I think this is something really powerful. And I think that we have to do this not just as we're watching the debates. We need to do this in community. We can say, okay, what kind of decisions are we going to make? And they're hard decisions. Mm-hmm. You know, I was just on this panel about Black generational wealth and housing. And this, actually, let me give a better example. So my aunt lives on the East Coast. She bought a house for $32,000 in a Boston suburb. That house is now worth a lot more than a $32,000. Mm-hmm. And I went to go see her right before a book talk. And she says, all day long, they call me about my house. Sometimes it's people saying, we will move you out of your house. We'll pay your moving expenses. We'll find you a senior place to live in. And she said, well, how long do they think I'm going to live? I can't afford that, right? And then the mail came. It was a stack of letters, real estate inquiries, because they know that if she sells this house, that land that has this kind of two split houses, you can make maybe 10, 20 condos if you make them tiny enough, right? So she's sitting with this, and her kids are, you know, in her ear, and people are in her ear, but she says, this is my home, and I'm going to stay here. And the strategy isn't to say, okay, you stay here, but how are we going to keep her there? Mm-hmm. That, for me, is a more interesting use of time than to say, well, if you took all of the capital out of your house, I've got these business opportunities for you, right? Because she says she wants to stay in her house because the family she rents the other side of the house to, they don't have any money. She says, where are they going to move to?
Right?
And, you know, you sit there and these are the struggles because there is an entire logic that says that she is a fool. Mm-hmm. But perhaps we are the fools to think that someone should sell their house like that, right? Mm-hmm. And so this is so poignant for this area of the country, but this is what people are struggling with. And this is what we need to just kind of talk about and be encouraged that there's another way of leaving a legacy and there's another way of creating wealth. Because if we are following this old script, what we're going to get is Jim Brown at Trump Tower. No one needs that. That's not moving us, you know? God bless him. I need to write a biography of him. I talk about him all the time. He's fascinating for these reasons. Thank you.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was Professor of History and African American Studies at Georgetown University, Marcia Chatelain, whose new book is Franchise, The Golden Arches in Black America. She was joined in conversation by Brandy Thompson Summers. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Alex Espalay, Dan Folds, Lauren Lamboy, Carly Mari, and Aiden Nelson. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Tina Pamintuan is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Stephanie Singer. Thanks for listening.